morning I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the something that's very essential, some distinctions that are very essential so that one finds, we might say, right practice. Now already I've said right versus wrong. And this is the problem. Zen Master Mumon, in one of the verses in the Mumon Kan, says that those who live by right and wrong are impaled by right and wrong. So, whether this right and wrong be, what is the distinction here? Is this the right way to practice this kind of attentiveness or that kind of attentiveness? Or focusing on this versus that? And how can I get to enlightenment without aiming at it? And so on. I don't need to elaborate. But what a person does need to do is to discern underneath what's going on in one's being to see if it's one more of those. If it's one more of those trying to get the right side of the coin, trying to get the right rule, try to follow it in order to get something. That profoundly works against the fruits, you might say, or the results of the spiritual life, which are no less and no more than coming to know, we call it in Zen, fundamental reality. In Christianity, they may call it one's communion with God. In Hinduism, they may speak of Atman and Brahman are the same. These are all simply designations. As you know, this mind is that we have, that has led to the survival of our species on the planet, is finely tuned to put matters into categories, to name things and to form relationships between those categories and names. For good purpose, for the creation of maps and guidelines that allow us to operate effectively in the various contexts of our life and fundamentally to lead to our survival. That's why we're all here, as we often say. Our ancestors were good at it. However, again, to reemphasize something that I keep saying over and over, in this domain, the domain of coming to know one's true life and to really find freedom and to really know who and what one is, this manner of approach is, instead of being facilitating the way it is in samsaric matters, it is actually profoundly inhibitory. And to the degree that you hold on to this as a mechanism for doing what you think the spiritual life is, to that degree, it will not be effective. You may get certain things that are nice to have, serenity, occasional bliss, so on. But it does not develop the continual connection from which your life can flourish. The continual connection with who and what you really are. Get little glimpses of what feel like it, but you don't know it for what it is. So it's important to find the way of persisting through all the brambles that will attract one, the alternatives, the things that invite you to settle for this or settle for that, the great satisfactions of understanding. It's important to realize that you can do that, but it doesn't lead to life. And to find the way through the brambles and forests, using the guidelines that the true spiritual practice offers you as touchstones, as talisman, you might say. Again, be careful of all those words. In order to come to what we're really talking about. So Zen Master Hakuin speaks of the continual spirit of Zazen. That is to say, a kind of Zazen, the essence of Zazen, it is not restricted to sitting on a cushion, doing kinhin, and so on. Certainly, it may be learned best under those circumstances. But it is to be penetrated into what the essence is that can be carried into every activity of one's life. Now, we speak a lot of Zen, of course, that's our tradition. But it is not that this approach and this discovery is restricted to Zen. It is found in any place where people have not settled and who have kept their hunger and thirst for their true home alive and have persisted through the brambles and thickets of understanding and so on to arrive at their true home, to come finally to awakening to their life. So this morning I'd like to read and comment briefly on some selections from places other than Zen, and then to end, given our time, I'll try to watch that with a koan that exemplifies this form of practice. When you are at Sesshin, it is unique opportunity to maintain the practice constantly. Constantly, of course, means as best you can. There's nothing to be gained by condemning yourself or, for that matter, congratulating yourself. But you do your best. Whenever you catch it, you come back. You come back, you come back, you come back. In this coming back, it becomes habitual to come back, and finally it becomes a way of life that does not have any alternative, does not have any opposition. And then it becomes easy in the sense of there's no work involved. It just is the obvious thing to do. Like finally discovering that you walk on your legs instead of on your hands. So let's look first at a text that comes from another tradition. And this is from a little book. Book I would recommend if you don't get caught in the cosmology. By the way, people who do not understand the spiritual life get caught in cosmology. So they get caught in one metaphor versus another. This is the realm of the fundamentalists. This is the realm that where religion has been at the basis of terrible depredations throughout history. And not just religion, but any kind of fundamentalism, be it political or social or whatever. Any kind of place where people are putting an emphasis on the correctness of their truth without realizing that their truth is a metaphor, that it is insubstantial, that it is merely at best an inspiration. But it is not by any means a representation of the divine order, if we could use that term. That is to say, fundamental reality, or what we would call in Buddhism, Dharma Dhatu. They're all maps, they're all descriptions, they're all metaphors, to be evaluated only on the basis of the efficacy in producing progress towards a goal. Just like, exactly like, a highway map that is efficacious only if it gets you efficiently towards the city or town where you're wishing to go. But it is not, by any means, a representation of the terrain over which you drive. This is obvious, of course. But the same thing is true of religious postulates, cosmologies, stories, metaphors, that are the source of great battle between individuals and neglecting to realize that they, all of them, have no substance. They are but, at best, sources of inspiration, guidelines, like Om or Mu or Om Namah Shivaya, or whatever it might be that is a thing that one uses in order to retain centeredness, purity of mind, whatever it may be. But taken beyond that, such as is found in people studying the scriptures of Buddhism, or studying the scriptures of Hinduism, or studying the scriptures of Christianity, or Judaism, or whatever, studying them to learn the stories and all that, fine as a literary pursuit. But for someone thoroughly concerned with getting to the bottom of this matter, you look at these things for hints, for suggestions, for things that resonate with this supreme endeavor that it is your prime concern to engage with. So, here is a little piece from a person by the name of who was given the name of Brother Lawrence. He was a very unschooled person. As they say, low estate. He was born with the name of Nicholas Hermann and Lorraine in France. Maybe it was in Germany at that time. That part of the country goes back and forth for centuries between France and Germany. But at any rate, he had a revelation, a turning about in his being, which in Christian terms is called a conversion. And from that time on, it occurred when he was 18, from that time on he joined the Carmelites in Paris. And he did this in 1666. And had a very long life, lived till he was 80. And during that time he was much respected as a vehicle of the purity of this spiritual life, and of putting everything secondary to it. And a person who experienced great benevolence in whatever he did, whether he fell, he was a man who was lame, he was a man who was apparently very awkward, he would bump into things and break things, and accidentally, because of his, maybe we would say his bumbling nature. But throughout all of this, he experienced his life in the continual presence, and that is why it is called the practice of the presence of God, the continual presence of this true home for him. So I'm reading this because he speaks here of what Bhagavan would call the continual spirit of Zazen. So this is a letter that he wrote, and I just read most of the letters so that you will get a sense of this person, and you'll clearly see what I mean about the continual spirit of Zazen. So he says, "Since you desire so earnestly that I should communicate to you the method by which I arrived at that habitual sense of God's presence, which our Lord of His mercy has been pleased to vouchsafe to me, I must tell you that it is with great difficulty that I am prevailed on by your importunities. And now I do it only upon the terms that you show my letter to nobody. If I knew that you would let it be seen, all the desire that I have for your advancement would not be able to determine me to it. So the account I can give you is this." Now, when you hear him say, I'll go on to obviously read the rest of it, but when you hear him say that this has been this gift, he sees it as a gift that has been vouchsafed to him. The important thing for any spiritual life is not to feel that it is the result of some strategy that you have been successful at. For that only magnifies ego, and by that we mean magnifies the sense of separation. And the whole endeavor of this spiritual life is to heal this separation. You all know the Chinese character for the Buddha that basically shows a person standing beside two things bound together. It's a great depiction of what the function of the Buddha was in the world, to heal our human lesion. So anything that contributes to this human lesion, self-consciousness, self-congratulation, self-deprecation, self-punishment, any of these things are just indicators of the living within a dualistic world. And so they must all be dealt with real kindness. Now when you, when Brother Lawrence believes in his cosmology that all these things have come to him through the goodness of God, that they have nothing to do with anything that he ever did, he doesn't deserve any of it. In fact, in one place, I don't know if it's in this letter or not, he says that he has been disappointed by God. There's a very interesting reason why he says that, because he entered into this life because he felt he was such a sinner, such a person of abject lack of virtue and so on, that he expected to be punished thoroughly by entering into the religious life so that he could be purified of all these sins. And lo and behold, he entered it and he received nothing but happiness. Though he felt God had disappointed him. So this gives you a kind of indication of the battle, you might say, between one's cosmology. The cosmology says such and such. But the world is quite different from that. The divine order is not, for Brother Lawrence, the map of the divine order. And that's why he can say, expressing the experience difference between the two, that God has disappointed me. Now, he did not dwell upon that. That was a comment he made at one time. He was only profoundly grateful at all times that he was that he had received the gift of being able to live in a world of congruence. And that came about in the way that you'll see here, which is not unlike the practice of the continual spirit of Zazen. So he says, having found in many books different methods of going to God and diverse practices of the spiritual life, I thought this would serve rather to puzzle me than facilitate what I sought after, which was nothing but how to become holy gods. Now that's interesting, isn't it? What perception this man who thought he was so, who was really unlearned in the sense of unschooled, he did search through books for things, but he had that real perceptiveness that comes from the abiding hunger for knowing your true home. That he was able to say, he looked through all these books and found all these methods, but he thought they would serve rather to puzzle him than to facilitate what he really sought after. And that kind of end of the ropes has to happen for everyone. So that, as you've often heard me say, readings, Zen writings and so on, is only for inspiration. Hints and suggestions that then will nurture your practice. But it is not a place to find any answers. Only hints and guidelines. Inspirations. Resonances. So he goes on. He says, this made me resolve to give the all for the all. So, having given myself wholly to God that he might take away my sin, I renounced for the love of him everything that was not he. And I began to live as if there was none but he and I in the world. Sometimes I considered myself before him a poor criminal at the feet of his judge. At other times I beheld him in my heart as my father, as my God. I worshipped him the oftenest that I could, keeping my mind in his holy presence and recalling it as often as I found it wandered from him. I found no small pain in this exercise. That remind anybody about the difficulty of dealing with the wandering mind. And yet I continued it, notwithstanding all the difficulties that occurred, without troubling or disquieting myself when my mind had wandered involuntarily. I made this my business, as much all the day long as at the appointed times of prayer. For at all times, every hour, every minute, even in the height of my busyness, I drove away from my mind everything that was capable of interrupting my thought of God. Of course, be careful, this is not the thought of an entity, but abiding in this nameless. For us, it would be abiding in this mysterious mu or hu, for example. The mysteriousness of it, not the specificity of it. Not that mu is what Joshua said to the monk who asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? But it is that about which you're trying to find the totality and enter into it and identify solely with that. This is the language of Brother Lawrence also. He says to become holy gods. That is to say, nothing else in the world. And likewise, when we are practicing mu or hu, there should be nothing else in the mind but just that, at all times. In other words, when it drops away all the names and distinctions, one goes before that hyperactive mind had to name everything and put everything in relationship. But all these things that it had named, all these things that it had acted as though they had a reality that they do not have. It's only attributed reality. To act as though they have some kind of individual, separate reality. And then put these things that have been totally created for convenience by an individual into relationship with each other to create cosmologies and theories and all the rest of it. It is a very complicated, brambly thing. Spiritual life, on the other hand, as exemplified here by Brother Lawrence, by Hakuin, by all the great Zen masters, is coming through all that, adopting an attitude to all those activities of mind, not to denigrate them, not to put them down, not to deny them, but to recognize the domain where they are of value and the domain where they are of no value. And learn the art of dealing with that domain where they are of no value. This is the art of the spiritual life. So here, underneath and through that, he says that somewhere else here, I don't know if it's in this letter or not, but I don't want to read too many of them, but there is another letter where he says that and this is almost heretical for a person back in the late 1600s, early 1700s, to say that when he does his prayers at the appropriate time, he does, I don't know if I can find exactly where he says, but he says he does only, oh, here it is. He says, I have quitted all forms of devotion and set prayers, but those to which my state obliges me. In other words, being a monk, being a Carmelite, there would be certain times in the day when certain prayers would be said, and he would say them at those times. But inwardly, his life was so much vaster than all these prayers and all these designated times that he says here in this letter, and I don't know if he received a hard time from his superiors about this, but he said, I have quitted all forms of devotion and set prayers, but those to which my state obliges me. And I make it my business only to persevere in his holy presence, wherein I keep myself by a simple attention and a general fond regard to God, which I may call an actual presence of God, or, to speak better, an habitual, silent, and secret conversation of the soul with God. But there's something about this. Some of you have asked me in Doksan about this practice versus that practice and so on. And the important thing is to go underneath them all to that place that is really has a silence that encompasses all the sounds of the world. A silence, that is to say, that disregards but does not deny or denigrate, but lets be all the sounds and all the ideas and all the sights and whatever of your world, whether you consider it to be inside or outside. Now that is to go to the place that is gets closer and closer to the source, the place where the true uncovery, discovery can be made of who you really are. And your feet planted firmly in that environment so that it becomes that which you will be nourished with constantly. Just as what Brother Lawrence here is speaking about, his continual say nourishment by this continued conversation, as he calls it. That's another little section here in a later letter. It says, my most useful method is this simple attention and such a general passionate regard to God, to whom I find myself often attached with greater sweetness and delight than that of an infant at the mother's breast, so that if I dare use the expression, I should choose to call this state the bosom of God, for the inexpressible sweetness which I taste and experience there. If sometimes my thoughts wander from it by necessity or infirmity, I am presently recalled by inward motion so charming and delicious that I am ashamed to mention it. I desire your reverence, this is the person to whom he's sending the letter, to reflect rather upon my great wretchedness, of which you are fully informed, than upon the great favors which God does me, all unworthy and ungrateful as I am. As for my set hours of prayer, they are only a continuation of the same exercise. Sometimes I consider myself there as a stone before a carver, whereof he is to make a statue. Presenting myself thus before God, I desire to form his perfect image in my soul and make me entirely like himself, and so on and so on. So, you get some sense of how this man operates within his belief system, but to doing his best to penetrate underneath to what is essential. And to the degree that he resonates and touches and lives from that essential, to that degree, he receives the consolations and fruits of that contact. He words it in a certain way, of course, because that is his background. He knows no other way. But it is important to understand that those who have persisted in whatever culture, whatever time, in whatever tradition of belief, who have persisted and have listened rather for the hints and the resonances within whatever that tradition is, and have tried to live as best they can by that and discover a simplicity and a non-distractibility, to that degree, it follows as the night the day that they will come into the presence of this fundamental nature. So there is no difference, for we are all human beings growing up in one context or another, one cosmology or another, one tradition or another, and yet resonating with the essence, we all, whether in this part of the world or that part of the world, at this time or that time, with this language or that language, we resonate with what is fundamentally true of us human beings. Zen happens to put it in a straightforward and direct way without cosmology and without metaphor, calling it something like fundamental nature, our original self. But it is the same. Wherever one out of one's eagerness and one's hunger and one's dedication and following in whatever tradition the three pillars of Zen, when one does that, one inevitably comes to know this fact of one's being. Let's see if there's anything else here. So he says, finally, by often repeating these acts, that is to say, bringing himself back and bringing himself back and bringing himself back, they become habitual. And the presence of God renders, as it were, natural to us. So, this is his cosmology. And you find this in many, many places in different traditions. You can look at a person by the name of Nisargadatta in the Hindu tradition, and you find it there, this wonderful simplicity of practice, this undeviating application of the practice. Taking it as just a simple thing and abiding with and utilizing that in all contexts. Not the complexities. Going beyond all complexities. For all these complexities have been creations afterwards, after fundamental nature, after true self. They have been created by this resourceful and sincere and yet ignorant mind. Ignorant in the sense of ignoring what is fundamentally being done as we create these representations. It is these representations that lead people into trouble. We see this over and over and over. Came across a quotation from Voltaire the other day. Voltaire said, if they can make you believe in absurdities, they can make you commit atrocities. That's applicable, whether it's a national absurdity, whether it's a social absurdity, whether it's a political absurdity, whether it's a religious absurdity. You can make you believe in absurdities, they can make you commit atrocities. Not the least of which is the atrocity towards oneself. Bad enough towards others, but also towards oneself, continuing in a process of self-punishment or self-abnegation, or almost just as bad, self-congratulation and self-elevation. See underneath. I was going to read something from the Awakening of Faith attributed to Ashvaghosha. But essentially, it speaks of the same thing, and perhaps we will reserve that for another time. I just want to read, before we finish this morning, a koan in the Hekigen Roku that relates very much to the continual spirit of Zazen. And it's one that you've probably heard me talk about many times because it's one of my favorites. This is case number 44. In the Hekigen Roku, that collection of koan, of 100 koan, we use in our particular school of Zen. And it goes like this. Kasan said, learning by study is called hearing. Learning no more is called nearness. Transcending these two is true passing. A monk asked, what is true passing? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk asked again, what is the true teaching of the Buddha? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk asked once more, I would not ask you about this very mind as the Buddha, but what is no mind, no Buddha? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk still continued to ask, when an enlightened one comes, how do you treat him? Kasan said, beating the drum. It This is a marvelous koan, in my opinion. The misunderstanding of the koan would be to think that one needs to go and buy a drum. Take it with you wherever you go. And indeed, that kind of thing has been done. You've all heard me speak of the peak beside Vulture Peak where there's vast drum and this stupa and the monks 24/7, month after month, year after year, continue to beat this great drum that echoes out over the drum. I may be exaggerating the way people do with the fish story, but I think it was a vast drum head. I don't know from what animal the skin was obtained, but it seemed to be five feet across, maybe 6 feet across. Vast, vast drum that had a wonderfully deep and resonant sound, which I heard miles away as I moved towards this Vulture Peak in my pilgrimage in India in 1978. I heard this sound and I couldn't see any source for it. All I heard was bump, 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 bump. And as I got closer, it got louder, but I didn't know what I was getting closer to. I just heard this sound increase in volume. And finally, I got to Rajgir, and I finally climbed up this mountain, and lo and behold, here were these folks on top of the mountain, just a little temple, and monks replace each other 24/7, take up the beat that never, ever stopped. It's meant to be that the Dharma continues. The Dharma, the wheel of the Dharma is continually turning. It's got the continual manifestation of this teaching of the Buddha in the world. But what Kassan is speaking of is something much vaster and more profound than that. It is an attitude of mind that realizes that every moment is the same as every other moment with respect to the manifestation of life. Whether it be birth or death, whether it be pain or joy, it is the same. Beating the drum means that. In Zen, we speak of four great wisdoms. And one of the great wisdoms is the great mirror wisdom. And you know that when a mirror is held up to the world, it reflects everything equally. And when you turn the mirror to something else, it bears no trace of that which it was reflecting before, but now fully and completely depicts that which is facing. This is an analogy of the continual spirit of Zazen. And it's what I mean by the same. From the world of differentiation, eating rice is different from sweeping the floor, driving a car, working the stock market, plucking apples from a tree. They're all different, are they not? But from the viewpoint of the style and manner of dealing with them, they are all beating the drum. The cultivation of this style of being with whatever your karma brings to you is what we mean. Don't get caught in any of the differentiations. They will all follow. Whatever your profession is, whatever you have to do or say, wherever you have to walk, whatever activities come to hand as your karma to do, they will follow easily from this place. Trust it. The intention in cultivating the spiritual life is to come to this authentic place. And in a zendo, during sashin, the manner in which one gets oneself into that mode is to treat everything that occurs during the Sesshin with this same attitude. You just do it. No comparison. No naming. No understanding. No placing it in a framework of time. No relating it to a self who is doing it. No comparing with other people doing a similar thing. But solely, totally absorbed and losing yourself and everything in this one thing. That one thing that is what is at hand. And when sitting on the cushion, it is this body, this breath, this move, this who. These are your great friends. These are, as I sometimes change the quote of that quotation that I was inspired by ever since I first heard it as a boy, a quotation that was one of the favorites of King George VI, the member I grew up in Canada. And this was a very humble man for being king. Very wonderful man, actually. He didn't really want to have the position, but his brother abdicated and he had to do it. And he had a wonderful quotation, and I will change the word God to Mu. And you change it into whatever form is appropriate for you. But he said, go out into the darkness and put your hand, this is the modified quotation, put your hand into the hand of Mu. That will be to you better than light and safer than a known way. Now this is what is meant by beating the drum. This is why Kassan said, no matter what that you present to me, no matter what it is, the teaching of the Buddha, meeting an enlightened person, whatever it is always beating the drum. Likewise here, if you ground yourself in this place and consider everything like that and drop all comparison, all self-consciousness, all these stories, and just be extraordinarily simple. You know, we say in Zen, justice, justice. You be extraordinarily simple. That extraordinary simplicity, holding only to this one thing, will enable you to go easily through all the brambles and thickets, all the jungles of the mind, all the things that used to distract you, that used to offer you things to ponder, things to use as a source of happiness or sadness, going beyond them all relentlessly, joyfully, I would say, meaning with total abandoning of everything. Leaping thoroughly into it. Letting go of everything but that. And you continue that. It used to be what the old Zen masters would say, that if you do this for 7 days, nay, even 3 days, if you don't come to enlightenment, you can cut off my head. This is absolutely a certainty. This is not the domain of spiritual geniuses. This is not the domain of people of the past. This is about you. Do not denigrate yourself by thinking that this is beyond your capacity. I urge you not to settle for anything less than it. And I urge you, utilize this session to joyfully, joyfully let go of everything. But this, which you call your practice, to the degree that you do that, this fundamental nature will meet you, and you will know what it is you will awaken to without any question. I tell you this from my experience. We'll end there today. Thank you.